Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in this morning for Diane Rehm while she's away on vacation. U.S. deaths in Afghanistan surged to a record high this month. Vice President Biden said the war is worth the sacrifice, and he warned of more casualties ahead. In Iran, the key opposition leader said he would lay the groundwork for a large-scale social movement following disputed election results. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, on a long trip to Asia, a meeting with Southeast Asian leaders. The Obama White House wants to strengthen its partnerships in that region. Joining me in the studio for the International Hour, the Friday News Roundup, David Hoffman. He is the Assistant Managing Editor for Foreign News at The Washington Post, also a longtime foreign correspondent in Moscow and other places. Elise Labatt is the producer covering State Department for CNN, and Daniel Dombey, U.S. diplomatic correspondent for the Financial Times. Welcome to you all. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Give us a call, 1-800-433-8850. drshow@wamu.org is our email address. David Hoffman, Afghanistan. We talked about this rising death toll, not only American troops, but British troops as well, at a time when there is a real election campaign going on in Afghanistan, and in part because of the election campaign, American troops in the field trying to pacify areas of the country that have been under Taliban control. Give us an update of what's happening on the ground.
Well, you know, there's a big offensive in the south in Helmand province, and it's really worth watching. It's kind of a test case because the goal of this offensive is to take a whole province and try and, you said, pacify it or maybe essentially bring some kind of peace and security to it. And I'm not sure they're going to be able to do that, but they're trying very, very hard, committing a lot of troops. And I think there's going to be rising violence. There's still violence in the east. And this campaign that's happening, Karzai is the president of the country. He's running for re-election. But it's a campaign really from the place he controls, which is Kabul in the center. His writ doesn't really run to the whole country. So it's a very, very precarious time. And we've seen in Britain and also in Canada, which has committed a lot of troops, growing disenchantment with this war. And I think that this is the big challenge for the United States.
And Daniel, you mentioned Britain. Prime Minister Gordon Brown is actually having even more political problems than President Obama in terms of the death toll of British troops, this whole controversy over whether enough helicopters provided. It's really affecting his government.
It's affecting his government. One of the things that makes it difficult is that his government is a very weak government in any case. A lot of heat was put onto the British government after 8 soldiers were killed in a single day and 15 in a single week. The problem is that this is really, really high-intensity war. Some of the commanders in the field say that you're advancing only 300 metres in a day. Think of that. That sounds like the World War One. This is in a part of the world where there are no safe roads because they're booby-trapped. And Mr. Brown is at odds with his own army, which says we need more men and we need more resources. In fact, we need more helicopters, because if we go down those roads, we're going to be blown up. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say, Mr. Brown yesterday sounded what to some people sounded a bit of a disingenuous note. He said, we don't need new helicopters. Helicopters isn't the issue. We need better mine-detecting equipment. But the problem is, if you have helicopters, you have much less likelihood of being blown up since you're going to be in the air.
Now, Elise Labatt, one of the important allies here, it's not just Britain that is being roiled by this war, it's Pakistan, the adjoining country, where there has been growing concern that this offensive that David described will just send insurgents across the border and destabilize Pakistan. Bring us up to date on that.
Well, Pakistan has always been concerned that as the United States adds troops to Afghanistan, that it would push the Taliban further into the south, over the border into Balochistan, which is already a very troubled province next to South Waziristan, where the Pakistanis are about to launch a major offensive. So this is nothing new in terms of their concern about it. But what the United States is asking them to put more troops to that area. And most of Pakistani troops are on the border with India because Pakistan sees India as its main threat. And this has been the issue over between the United States and Pakistan over the last several months. The United States has said, this is your existential threat, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, not India. And so now that Pakistan needs to send more troops to the area, they're making a lot more noise.
It goes back far longer than a few months. It goes back 40 years, where Pakistan has always said, no matter what you tell us, our main enemy is India, and that's where we're going to focus our attention.
That's right. But now that the United States wants Pakistan to send more troops to fight al-Qaeda
right.
and the Taliban,
it makes
the issue much more complicated.
Daniel?
Yeah, I would just say it's not exactly helpful, according to some, in some of Pakistani's eyes, that Hillary Clinton this week signed an arms treaty
That's
with India, which could pave the way to up to 100 fighter jets being sold to India from the US. Pakistan points at that and says, and now you're telling us that India's not a threat when you're selling them weapons? They're, of course, still smarting from a nuclear deal last year. And there's a bigger issue. The bigger issue is, really, how winnable is this war in Afghanistan? The Obama administration always portrayed this as the right war compared to Iraq, and it may be a better war than Iraq. It may be justified compared to Iraq. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be winnable, however.
And, David, one of the questions that has continued to bedevil policymakers, both in the previous administration, this one, is the hunt for Osama bin Laden. And we had news this week that the possibility that his son had been killed. And what do you know at the Washington Post, and what are your sources telling you?
Well, this son was apparently not killed because he was targeted. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. One of those unmanned drones came by and fired at someplace, and they're really still not sure. But, you know, the bin Laden equation is really at the center of our national purpose there. Mm-hmm. That's why we're doing this, right? And I thought it was very interesting. Joe Biden, the vice president, said yesterday the war in Afghanistan is still worth it. Why did he need to say that? I mean, really, I think a lot of Americans will be asking themselves, what is our national purpose? Is it
peace national interest?
An interest. Is it peace and prosperity in Helmand Province? You know, this is not necessarily the place where democracy has flowered through the ages.
Even if it was a legitimate national purpose, is it worth American lives?
Right.
A growing number of American lives.
But I think the bin Laden goal, getting bin Laden, you know, closing the book on this terrible chapter, it has been our goal. But Helmand Province is not where bin Laden is.
Well, I think you've seen over the last, since the administration took over, a kind of realistic nature in terms of setting greater realistic expectations of what's achievable in Afghanistan. When President Obama ran his campaign to get out of Iraq and pay more attention to the war in Afghanistan, it seemed that there were much more grandiose goals in terms of what was achievable in Afghanistan. Now you don't hear so much about democracy in Afghanistan. You hear about fighting extremism, fighting terrorism, and trying to go after al-Qaeda.
Although, Daniel, part of the rationale for the offensive in Helmand Province is to pacify the country on the eve of an election, therefore make the elections more valid, strengthen the hand of Karzai, who's likely to win, although he's in a tough fight. And that would, in the long run, help stabilize the country and advance American goals. But that's about a three-step argument. Go ahead.
I slightly differ with that. I mean, the Obama administration has had quite cold relationship with Karzai, and it would not be unhappy if the guy went.
You really think so?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Biden had a bad meeting with him. Hillary talked about the failings of the Afghanistan government when she gave her testimony. They would rather he wasn't there, but they feel they're going to have to live with him for some time. However, I slightly also disagree, since I'm in an argumentative mood, with Elise, because I think that you had a classic example of how Washington works and why that matters in the world when they came up with this big review, which supposedly was really going to focus on the essential in Afghanistan. And apart from a little less talk about democracy, I think that it's fair to say that they're still very ambitious in Afghanistan. They want to improve governance. They want to protect populations. They're not just going to strike al-Qaeda. They're trying to make the population secure in a country which is very, very difficult to.
I want to move on, and you mentioned earlier Secretary Clinton's trip, and there were a number of dimensions to this. You mentioned the treaty signed in India, but also there was an exchange with the North Koreans. At least bring us up to date on that.
Well, the war of words between Secretary Clinton and the North Koreans really heated up this week. Secretary Clinton was saying that North Korea is acting like a child, demanding attention. And as a mother, when you look at a child demanding attention, you don't give it to him. Thus, the low-key approach and the low-key rhetoric from the United States about North Korea over the last several weeks. And North Korea just can't resist a comment like that. And so fought back and saying, well, Hillary Clinton is vulgar. She doesn't have any tact. She is a petulant school child and sometimes looks like a pensioner going shopping. I mean, the rhetoric really raised to a level of kindergarten teasing.
Or reduced to a level of kindergarten.
Exactly. But this is really all about Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration kind of feeling its way on what to do with North Korea, because North Korea has said that the six-party talks aimed at ending its nuclear program is dead. It's not going to attend and is going to go ahead with its nuclear program. And so now the administration is trying to figure out how to handle this.
Now, there was also news made on Secretary Clinton's trip relating to the nuclear aspirations of another country when she said that, use the phrase, a defense umbrella. The American were ready and willing to do that in the Middle East should Iran achieve nuclear capabilities. That triggered, David, a lot of concern and a lot of explanations about what she really meant. What's the bottom line here?
Well, you know, we had never talked about it in the Middle East like that before. I think implicitly there has been such a thing. But I think what she's doing is raising the ante again with the Iranians. There's a clock ticking on this diplomacy, and she's aware that they have maybe only months, really, to get some results out of it. It's been dragging on for a long time, and the Iranians have proven very, very wily and very, very difficult to negotiate with.
And but one of the dimensions here is a lot of people objected to her language, saying you're conceding the possibility that Iran will, in fact, acquire this capability, Daniel.
Yes, she's talking about that as a scenario. Now, I think it's important to emphasize what David said. What she's trying to do is change the balance of motivations for Iran so that it doesn't develop a nuclear weapon. There's a very good chance that Iran just wants to be on the cusp of developing a nuclear weapon. But there's another, perhaps more important argument, which is some people say you've got to try engagement, you've got to try talking to Iran, but just have a reality check. What kind of Iran are you talking to, and how willing are they going to do this? You have to have another option.
We're going to deal with Iran as soon as we come back from our break. I'll be with you and my guests talking about the Middle East. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. And as always, on the second hour of our Friday News Roundup, we're focusing on international issues. Joining me to do that, Elise Labbitt of CNN, Daniel Dombey of the Financial Times, David Hoffman of the Washington Post. We started the conversation about Secretary Clinton's trip. But Elise, I want you to answer one other thing. We talked about the exchange with North Korea. We talked about the heard comments about Iran. Are we seeing a Secretary of State who's still learning the language and the customs of diplomacy, having to sort of rejigger two of her comments this week?
Well, it's unclear whether she has to rejigger her comments or she made the comments deliberately and then put them out there and then walk them back slightly. But as we were just discussing during the break, the comments are still out there and that they still stand. I mean, I think what Secretary Clinton is trying to do is send a message to Iran, send these messages without having to, if that's not actually the policy, without having to follow through, but raise the specter of the consequences if Iran or North Korea were to continue with their nuclear
missions. Now, David, internally in Iran, developments this week as well, the aftermath of this highly contested election, Mousavi talking about creating a social movement, continuing signs of splintering within the conservative religious establishment. Give us an update.
Well, I thought the most interesting thing was Rafsanjani's speech. And, you know, Rafsanjani was sort of the shadow gray cardinal behind the Mousavi campaign. And, you know, for him to speak out like that very, very frontally now, taking front and center.
Saying what? Tell our listeners what he said.
Well, saying basically that the country cannot accept this outcome of this election, you know, really speaking out, I think, in a way that he was reluctant to when the election was being disputed. Remember, this was really not an election that starkly pitted reformers or liberals on the scene. Mousavi mm-hmm. himself was not one. But the fact that it was stolen, the process was broken, I think is something that Ahmadinejad has not been able to shake. And to have Rafsanjani speak out like this really suggests, as you said, a splintered, fractured leadership of the country. And that has not been the case.
And Daniel, is it also true that despite the ability of the police and the military to repress the street demonstrations, that they have not extinguished the sense of frustration and protest that continues to simmer there in this country?
Oh, that's absolutely the case. And you're seeing things, the signs of protest, both at the upper levels of the elite and the level of ordinary life. And these are now low-level protests, but they recur with quite some frequency across the country. However, that said, I think you do need to bear two things in mind. One is that the Iranian elite is split, as it never has been before in 1979. Number two, if you're a betting man, and it's probably not advisable to be a betting man in the inner circles of the Iranian revolution, the status quo still holds many, many of the cards. The Revolutionary Guard still holds many, many of the cards. And although Rafsanjani's speech last week was incredibly important, and in fact another former president, Khatami, who is less of a mover and shaker but still important, also came out and attacked the result and the legitimacy of the regime, more recently you've seen a large number of people in one of the key assemblies of elders come out and say to Rafsanjani, you've got to show more loyalty. There is still strong pressure for loyalty for the regime despite the deep, deep splits.
And what's the analysis at the State Department, Elise, about what's going on and what role, if any, there is for American policy as this continues to roil Iran?
I think that they're still waiting to see how this plays out. The one thing that they know is that Iran has always been kind of masked in these layers of mystery, and there's no mystery now. I mean, this crisis has kind of really revealed a lot about the decision-making process in Iran. It looks much more different now, and they see that there's a big dent or a crack in the shield of the legitimacy of the supreme leader. And so I think that they're trying to see whether, you know, obviously they do expect Ahmadinejad to remain the president, but what kind of president is he going to be? How does that affect their ability to engage? Is he going to kind of pull back and not want to engage with the United States, or is he going to feel that now that he has so much opposition, he certainly comes to office as a weakened president, is he going to have to make some kind of gesture to the United States, to the international community, on the nuclear program to kind of calm things down
because there's so much opposition. That's where everything connects together.
Exactly. I think that, though, in terms of engagement, the kind of wholesale engagement, the grand bargain that the United States was planning with Iran when the Obama administration comes to office is not tenable right now. You don't hear the kind of talk about full-scale engagement. You do hear that we do have our national security interests. We will engage with Iran on the nuclear program. However, the idea of engagement will be more of a multilateral right now through the P5+1. And you hear a lot of analysts now and Iranians saying, let's not hear so much about engagement right now. Now is not the time.
Let's talk about neighboring country, Iraq. David Hoffman, Prime Minister al-Maliki, in Washington this week. Interestingly, not only in talks with President Obama, but also talking a lot about the economy of Iraq, an issue we don't hear a lot about, trying to drum up interest among American investors and entrepreneurs. Give us your take on his visit.
Well, I actually thought the most interesting thing was the president pledged to help get rid of these UN sanctions. You know, Iraq still has to pay billions of dollars to Kuwait in reparations. If they get some of that money, money back. That'll help them. And, you know, I think when Maliki goes home from Washington, it's going to look a lot grimmer on the ground there. And, there's a big election coming in the next few days in Kurdistan. It's very important. The parties that have led Kurdistan are being challenged by an upstart party. I think Kurdistan is the real new front line, the real flashpoint in potential sectarian tensions in Iraq. So Maliki's country's not all together yet.
You mentioned there are several issues here, including in his conversations with President Obama, the whole issue of the deadline of withdrawal of American troops. What did we learn?
Well, I think, we're committed to the deadline, but what's going to happen is the deadline's going to be tested, and it was just tested this morning. There's going to be firefights, and there are going to be military conflicts involving all these rules and deadlines, and those things, they're very, very sensitive and volatile.
Talk, Danielle, about the sense of national unity. David raises this issue. Kurdistan, over weeks now, there's been increasing assertion of independence on the part of Kurdish leaders. There's a huge fight over the status of Kirkuk, an oil-rich area. Is Iraq holding together? Is there a real threat to its national unity here?
I think both are true. I mean, Iraq is holding together to the moment, but the Kirkuk is the biggest unsolved problem of Iraq, not least because of the oil revenue, but also because of the relationship between Kurds who have come in and Turkmens who were there before. But I think just to look at Maliki's visit, I think that you need to bear two things in mind. This is a cold relationship, rather like the relationship with Karzai. And if you looked at some of the President Obama's comments when he talked about wanting an Iraq where everyone could thrive, Shia, Sunni and Kurd, didn't take a genius, it didn't take a Sherlock Holmes to see that the U.S. worries that Maliki could be a bit more of a narrow sectarian than it would like. Mm-hmm. And there's that tension there. There's also a little bit of tension about how much freedom of maneuver the U.S. military has following the June the 30th pullout. And I would say Iraq's economic situation is hard. Their biggest thing is oil. They had a big auction to sell rights to 8 big oil fields near Basra. Only one of those went through. That seems to be renegotiated. It's still the British are kind of less keen than they were. They're not getting the investors they need at a time that the oil price is going down. And you need oil and money to grease the wheels to make Iraq a more coherent place.
Right. Part of the issue is that there hasn't been enough national reconciliation in the country. And the issue is the part of the reason for the surge was not just in 2007, was not just to improve security, but it was to give the political space for more reconciliation. And that never happened. And the kind of grand constitutional bargain and the concessions that were necessary to make that were never completed. So what President Obama was saying to Maliki, you need to do this. You need to not only include Sunnis into the political process, but you need to settle some of these issues with the Kurds. And Maliki said to him, we need your help on doing this. We understand that there'll be a military disengagement, but it can't be a political disengagement because Iraq has a lot more challenges that not only are in a sectarian nature, but go to the whole future of the country. Is the power going to be in the central government? Is it going to be in the provinces? Who's going to have control over the oil and the natural resources? I mean, these are major issues that the Iraqis are going to have to resolve, and they are looking for the United States in many ways to help mediate these.
And there were stories this week about this pact or protocol that was apparently signed with Sunnis in Turkey. What was that all about?
It's not really clear, but there were two meetings between Americans and representatives of the Sunni insurgency that were held in Turkey. It's really the third meeting is the mystery. Why didn't it happen? It was scheduled. The Americans didn't come. There's some signs of some disenchantment, maybe, that this wasn't really a very good channel or it wasn't working. But I do think it's at least an indicator of it, that reconciliation's got to be the goal.
And let's talk Lisa, one other American, not just Secretary of State, abroad this week, but the Vice President, former Chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a very experienced well-connected man around the world, Joe Biden in Georgia and Ukraine. Talk about his trip and what he was trying to accomplish.
Well, Vice President Biden went to Georgia and Ukraine to kind of send the message to both countries that even though the United States is so-called pressing the reset button with Russia and improving its relations and strengthening ties on a whole front of areas of cooperation, this isn't necessarily a bad thing for these countries. These countries are worried that the improved ties between Russia and the United States would mean that the U.S. would kind of sell them out. And Biden was saying, no, if we continue to cooperate with Russia, they're going to be less inclined to intervene in the post-Soviet space, and that can actually benefit you. And he was also reassuring them about NATO and issues of, we still want you to move towards the West, we want you to move towards NATO, although it's very questionable whether these countries are going to join NATO and, in the case of Ukraine, even want to.
Well, and I thought it was very interesting, Daniel, that he, at the same time, while being quite supportive in Georgia, warned the government there's not a military solution to your problems with Russia, and that and he used the analogy of Eastern Europe and the fall of the Berlin Wall, that you want to make your country so attractive that people will vote with their feet. It was an interesting analogy.
Yeah, I thought that was the second part of his message on both stops, to be honest. In both Ukraine and Georgia, he said, your revolutions, the Orange Revolution and the Rose Revolutions, are not complete. And in both, he came out with some pretty harsh criticism of their rule of law, of democracy, of the freedom of freedom of the press, and so on. This is the kind of tough love, if you can call it that, that the Bush administration didn't really deliver. And Mr. Biden also reminded the Georgians that he was the key figure in granting $1 billion of aid to Georgia in the immediate aftermath of the war, something he called for while a senator in the Bush administration picked up. He said, $1 billion is quite a lot of money for 5 million people, even where I come from. Well, and the U.S. wants something in return.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let me read some emails from some of our listeners. This is Randall in Cincinnati. With the death toll rising in Afghanistan, I want to know where the anti-war groups that were protesting during the Bush administration. The anti-war movement was seen and heard daily during the few years, but they seem to have disappeared in mainstream media since Obama was elected. Could it be these were just anti-Bush groups posing as anti-war groups? What do you think, David?
Well, I think also, you know, Obama did endorse deadlines. Troops have pulled back. The violence has gone down in Iraq. That may play a big part.
And Defense Secretary Gates and other senior officials have acknowledged that the administration has about 1 year to show some major progress in Afghanistan before they start to lose support in Washington and around the world. So if you don't see that kind of progress, those anti-war groups may be out in full force.
You're actually seeing the. What about in Britain? Are there anti-war groups responding to the death toll and the controversy? Are you seeing demonstrations of any kind in Britain?
You're not seeing large-scale demonstrations, certainly not of the kind that you saw in the immediate run-up to the Iraq war when you had a million people on the streets. But you are seeing still a very divided population. In fact, the support for this war has gone up because people don't like the sense of being beaten by someone, and they don't like the sense of people being killed in vain. Neither of those are really strategic considerations, but both are very human. However, people remain deeply divided in British public opinion about whether it's a just war, and even more divided about whether it's a winnable war.
Diane writes to us from Intervale, New Hampshire. Afghan President Hamid Karzai failed to show up at a debate of presidential candidates. This happened yesterday, I believe, saying he felt the format would be biased against him. Would your panel comment on this, David?
Well, you know, I think Karzai ought to show up. And, you know, he doesn't rule enough of this country to be skipping out. And I think that's part of the reason why Americans are very, very cool and worried about him, because after all these years in power, they wonder if he's got the strength to take Afghanistan where they want to go.
Does he? What is the betting, Elise, on this election? He has two significant opponents. What are you hearing at the State Department?
Well, at first, I think everybody expected that Karzai was going to win. And as we were discussing earlier, they were kind of reluctantly resigned to the fact that they would have to deal with him. So they better start, you know, increasing cooperation with him. But in the last couple of weeks, Abdullah, the former foreign minister, has shown a strong showing. And he is seen as the guy to beat Karzai. It's unclear whether he'll really actually pull it off. But he is promising to tackle corruption, which has been a big complaint of the Karzai administration, and possibly one of the kind of suspicions of one of the reasons that he didn't attend is because he thought that Abdullah Abdullah would give him a run for his money at this debate.
Since the format is biased against me, I'm not going to comment on that.
Well, I'll comment on this one then. Licia from St. Louis writes, how is Secretary of State Hillary Clinton doing in the panel's opinion? Is she standing out in her position because of any of her meetings with the officials of other countries? What are you hearing? What kind of grades are you getting?
I think Hillary Clinton has a star power and a force on the international presence that no other choice that Obama could have made would have had. I think it shows a sign for the unity of the U.S. administration that two former rivals have combined in this way. That said, she has a certain, there are two issues. She has a certain frank style, a frank speaking style, which she's always had, which sometimes is very refreshing and some people see as a positive advantage and sometimes has to be walked back. And there remains the question about how closely allied she and Obama really are on fundamental issues. On the campaign, she had much more warlike language about Iran, for example. It's suspected that she's been that she was more sympathetic towards Israel. Thus far, on policy issues, there's been no division. But she is still looking a little bit for a role, I think, in some areas.
Well, this is an interesting question, Elise, because you get something with star power, but it can also be a drawback. She has her own independent constituency. She has her own independent reputation.
Well, I think what's interesting is that Hillary Clinton, as Daniel was indicating, hasn't really defined what her signature issue is going to be. Joe Biden seems to have being the guy who's going to handle the Iraq file. You have Richard Holbrooke, who has been given Afghanistan, Pakistan, a major initiative of this administration. George Mitchell is handling the Middle East. And Secretary Clinton hasn't kind of defined what she wants to do. Right now, she's made it soft power, that the United States is not just about traditional diplomacy in a boardroom with, you know, pinstripe diplomats drinking tea. It's going to be getting out into the field and talking to entrepreneurs and talking to the people that are really driving change in this world. And I think you saw that in India.
And we're going to come back with your phone calls. You have some patience. We'll be right back and we'll answer your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's pleasure you're about.
That's the late jazz singer Anita O'Day. Music critic Will Friedwald described her as always the greatest, the coolest, the hippest, and the swinginest. The documentary Anita O'Day, The Life of a Jazz Singer, just came out on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we'll feature an interview with O'Day from our archive. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane. And as always on Friday, the second hour of our news roundup focuses on foreign issues. Joining me on the panel today, David Hoffman, former foreign correspondent of The Washington Post, now foreign assistant managing editor for Foreign News. Elise Labbitt, who is at the State Department for CNN, and Daniel Dombey of the Financial Times. And let's talk to some of our callers. And Anne in Manchester, New Hampshire, welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning. Would your panel please clarify what Terry Gross brought up yesterday in her interview with Physicians for Human Rights, who discovered a grave site in Afghanistan approximately 40 meters long and investigated it later on with the UN protection that Taliban prisoners were killed by a member of the Northern Alliance en route to the prisons in early 2002 with U.S. knowledge or complicity. And Dashti Lely is either a name or a place. Would you clarify, please? And thank you.
Thank you. What do we know?
I'm not sure I can clarify very much. I do know that there have been news reports that there have been atrocities committed and prisoners of war massacred by people who were affiliated to General Dostum, who is an ally of President Karzai. The reports on that are cloudy. President Obama has said that he's going to be looking into it. I think that indicates there's going to be some kind of investigation. Certainly, Mr. Karzai's association with Dostum is something that causes the U.S. and many human rights groups a very great level of concern.
Give us a call. We have a couple lines open. We're going to turn to our calls now. 1-800-433-8850. As always, drshow@wamu.org. And join our conversation here. And Anne in Washington, D.C., welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show. Anne?
Oh, yes.
You're on the air. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I'm a member and have worked for the Answer Coalition, which is an anti-war coalition, for the last 7 years. It isn't a question of who is in the White House. I personally support President Obama, except when it comes to Afghanistan and whatever support he still gives to Israeli initiatives. I think you will be seeing more anti-war protests as time goes on, because the money that we're spending in Iraq and the money we give to Israel could be better spent at home for jobs and health care and education.
Thanks very much, Anne. David, talk about this whole question of the balance between foreign and domestic needs and the ongoing expenditures that Anne raises.
Well, as everybody can tell from the economic crisis we've had, we've just invested trillions for banks and try and keep our economy afloat. So there's going to be enormous amount of pressure on defense spending. People are going to be asking, what's it for? Do we need all these submarines and everything else that we spend money for? And I think a very, very interesting point is going to be, how long can Obama sustain the political support for the war in Afghanistan? And that goes back to what I raised earlier about our national interest. It's very interesting to look at what's happened in Canada. They've been focused on Afghanistan for years and years now, and the support's waning because of the high toll and because of the real question of what's the goal. And I think that this is going to be just like Iraq, a question of domestic politics and of domestic needs against those abroad. It's going to be a testing time.
Now, Elise, one of our listeners raises yet another hot spot, which is Burma. One of the countries that was on Hillary Clinton's list as she traveled through Asia and made some news on that issue as well.
Well, there's been a major review on Burma that's gone on since the Bush administration took over, since the Obama administration took over. They've shown that engagement hasn't worked, sanctions hasn't worked, and what can they do? Right now, it's all coming down to the release of Aung San Suu Kyi. This week in Bangkok,
Who is, of course, the Nobel Prize laureate who has been in prison now for many years.
That's right. Secretary Clinton this week in Phuket, Thailand, at the ASEAN meeting, had kind of very pointedly and very personally called for the release of Aung San Suu Kyi and for the junta there to allow her to participate in the political process, and held out the specter of improved relations with the United States if they were to let her and other political prisoners go. It was not just about improved relations. It was improved trade. You know, they're hanging out a whole series of incentives, which they're not making public, but it includes trade, perhaps putting an ambassador back there if they were to do this. And there's a lot of concern about Burma, not only about the political situation. President Obama had imposed a ban on investments in May because of their political oppression of dissidents, but also about suspected cooperation with North Korea over nuclear cooperation. And there was a ship that was steaming towards Burma over the last couple of months. The U.S. intervened with China to ask Burma to say, no, we're not going to board that ship.
And one of the interesting dimensions here, Daniel, is that the former First Lady, Laura Bush, continues to make Burma an issue of concern. She's been writing about it. She's been speaking about it. And she is increasingly outspoken in keeping this country that a lot of Americans tend to forget about in the news.
Yes, that's right. And of course, Burma is a place where there are enormous concerns about human rights abuses, about the repression of peaceful protests in 2007, and other massacres beyond that. But I think this also shows the real limits of U.S. influence to date. I mean, I have to say the auguries are not promising on Aung San Suu Kyi's release. The Burmese regime refused Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, permission to see her relatively recently. And they've let her trial for a ridiculous case where she gave some crazy American who swam over to her lakefront villa a bed for the night and is being prosecuted on that basis and could face 5 years in jail. They've delayed that until after the regional Asian meeting at which Hillary attended. The suspicion is that now that meeting's over, now the pressure's up, they'll sentence her.
Let me read, David, relates to a comment you made, I think. Dave Cook writes to us, I take issue with your guest's assertion of our foggy or non-existent purpose for fighting the war in Afghanistan. The Taliban and Osama attacked America, and they have reconstituted themselves to rise again.
It's certainly true that al-Qaeda attacked America, but the Taliban gave the al-Qaeda sanctuary, but they never set foot here. And the real question is, do we fight in Afghanistan to get bin Laden, or are we trying to eradicate the Taliban from the country? And if we're attempting to do that, then we need to devote the resources to that. And as the military has been saying, if we're going to fight that war, then we really have to fight it. And I think that's the unsettled issue.
And here's another email from Irfan Ali, writes to us, I'm writing from McLean, Virginia. As I listen to your guests and consider all the comments I have heard over the past few months about how Pakistan is being asked to devote more attention to its western border, it is annoying how you and much of the U.S. mainstream media chose to ignore the very active role Indian intelligence agencies are playing in this conflict zone. For the media and its many so-called experts to pretend that India is not actively exploiting the Afghan situation to its benefit is naive at best, irresponsible at worst. Daniel?
Well, there is certainly a tussle of wills between Indian and Pakistani intelligence officers in Afghanistan, and I think it's fairly true to say that there are quite a lot of Indian consulates with an interesting number of attachés. But I'm not sure that Pakistani supporters want to necessarily get into a war of words with India about whose intelligence service does most damage in Pakistan. There have been a series of allegations, some apparently well-founded, that the ISI, which after all...
which is the Pakistani intelligence and a notorious intelligence service.
Which really had an awful lot to do with support of the Taliban for years and years and years, was very involved in the bombing of the Indian embassy in Kabul last year. So I think that both intelligence services are involved in Afghanistan. The Pakistani one has reaped a fairly murderous harvest.
And as this email reflects a point we were making earlier, that no matter what the American interests are in this part of the world and know how... strongly try to get Pakistan to focus on Afghanistan and the Taliban, the specter of India has been there and will continue to be there as a part of their national interest.
Well, Pakistan sees India as its main threat, although they are starting to see the Pakistani Taliban as a big threat to them. And they have gone after Pakistani Taliban. And I think that's part of the reason that they've been cooperative with the United States over some of the drone attacks, not all of them, because now the United States is starting to go after some of this Pakistani Taliban. However, the United States is not immune to the fact that Pakistan does see India as a threat. And that's why you have seen increased diplomacy with India to try and calm the tensions between India and Pakistan so that Pakistan doesn't feel as threatened.
And I think Ram, who's on the line with us from Seattle, wants to talk about a similar subject. So, Ram, welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. And this is actually a nice segue to my question. And this notion of absolute parity between India and Pakistan is not only truly amazing, but it's very annoying. Now, just look at the question there, that both Indian and intelligence agencies are responsible for the mess. I mean, everybody knows the role of the Pakistani intelligence in fomenting terrorism in the region. Now, what has India got to do with all this? Now, my question to the lady who commented on Hillary Clinton's visit to India. Oh, the whole global, so-called global war on terror is so skewed, and it is predicated that terrorism perpetrated by Pakistan against India is of no consequence. It's all got to do with India and Pakistan tensions. And India has got to sit down, make concessions to Pakistan, so that Pakistan can then go and fight the West's war on terrorism. Now, what kind of skewed colonial logic is this? And my question is, did Hillary Clinton's visit along these lines elicit any tough reaction from the Indians?
Okay, Ram, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. Please go ahead.
I think that obviously there are discussions with the U.S. and India over terrorism. Part of the strategic dialogue is going to deal with terrorist issues. And Secretary Clinton did make a big showing to show respect for the attack in Mumbai last year, which is believed to have been perpetrated by Pakistani militant groups. I think that right now the relationship between the U.S. and India is focused on the economic front, that the cooperation, the nuclear cooperation, the technological cooperation, the economic cooperation that both countries can enhance one another.
And you were making the point that Secretary Clinton went out of her way to spend time in India talking with entrepreneurs. The economic relationship between the United States and India and the United States and China are absolutely central to any larger question of American interest.
That's right. And that's why her aides tell me that it was by design that she waited until the last day, until the last few hours to meet with Indian leaders, because these entrepreneurs, these green advocates, these university students, these are the ones that are driving the change in India right now, not only the government.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's now listen to Josh in Austin, Texas. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Josh.
Appreciate you. I just got a question about, I hear political analysts, and I'm a former Marine Iraq war vet, and I hear all this political back and forth over, the civilians and everything, and would you or would you not agree that all this media coverage and political analyst experts, so to speak, hinder military operations in these areas? I mean, what would have happened in Okinawa and Iwo Jima had there been, a concern for human rights? I mean, it's war is not a pretty place, and if you're not willing to do what you need to do in a war, then you need not be involved, in my opinion. So that's kind of what my statement / question.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. David Hoffman.
You know, I would just reply that the example of Iraq shows that in a democracy like ours, it's absolutely essential to have journalists on the battlefield. Our role is as important as the soldiers. People need to know what's happening there, Josh. They need to see it. And frankly, it helps raise the question of why are we there and do they support it?
And it's also true that Barack Obama, all through the campaign, connected this to American national interest, saying that if America did not live by its ideals, then that would be diminished in the world, and its ability to operate diplomatically would be diminished.
Yes, that's right. And I mean, I think the other point is that what is the U.S. trying to do? It dropped an awful lot of bombs on Iraq. It took a lot of Iraqi towns. The key for the U.S. policy in Iraq and U.S. policy in Afghanistan is to clear and hold, make sure that the population is secure, that insurgents don't come back. They've cleared and withdrawn. They've cleared and been beaten back. But to clear and hold, you need politics and you need respect for human rights.
Let me turn to Ted in New Haven. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Ted.
Thank you. It's amazing to hear you talk about human rights and America's wonderful role in the world. Since George Bush the Elder invaded, we had war, Gulf War, there have been probably close to 1 million dead children because of his sanctions. The Iraq War, as we all know, is a war crime. Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld should be in the dock at Nuremberg, but Nuremberg's not around anymore. And you talk about protesting. We protested like crazy before the Iraq War. Millions of people in Britain and Europe and America were running around the streets. Bush just mooned us. He didn't care. He wanted a war. And you correspondents who know better didn't write about that. And when you get embedded in Iraq, what are you going to... Remember Fallujah? Fallujah was considered Guernica. Now, I don't know if anybody here knows what Guernica was, but that's what Fallujah was described at. Was that reported in the American press? How about no? And I can go on.
Thank you very much, Ted. David Hoffman.
Well, I beg to differ. Our correspondents were there. We were there for every ugly difficult, violent chapter of this war, and we reported it on the pages of the newspaper, and that's the way it ought to be.
And let's turn to Eddie in Indianapolis. Welcome.
Hi, yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just want to say that I do appreciate the journalists that are doing their job, and it's helping me to understand and actually caused me to study more of the religious aspects of Iraq and the Middle East. So because of that, I'm very concerned about when we actually pull out the Sunni and Shia. Is there any prospects of true reconciliation between those two factions? Are there any social movements? Is there anyone like a Nelson Mandela in South Africa within Iraq right now that is calling for reconciliation between the religious factions in Iraq? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eddie. Please go ahead, Daniel.
Is there a Nelson Mandela in Iraq? He's been hiding, if there is.
Or she.
Or she. I quite right.
That's right.
Since we're talking about Aunt She.
Is there a possibility for reconciliation? Of course there is, because there's enormous pressure and people know what the stakes are. But it's not been very good progress on the political front for the last 3 or 4 years, because we're still talking about the things we were talking about 3 or 4 years ago. One of the things is the surge brought a certain amount of security and stability, much more than people expected. But fundamental political issues have yet to be resolved.
Final word, Lee.
I think the United States is looking to help play a role in terms of meeting some of these sectarian tensions. When Maliki was here this week, he asked the United States to help Iraq, particularly between the Arabs and Kurds, over some of these issues of Kirkuk. But you have a dozen fracture lines in Iraq right now, or half a dozen. You have Sunni Shia, you have Arab Kurd, you have all of these different Iran-Iraq, you have all of these different sectarian lines. And if any one of them were to descend into chaos, we could have a major problem in Iraq right now.
You just heard Elise Labbitt from CNN, also Daniel Dombey from the Financial Times, David Hoffman of the Washington Post. Thank you all for joining us on this Friday morning. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in this week for Diane Rehm, and appreciate very much all of you spending this morning and this week with us. Thank you for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.